Hi, welcome to the Behind the Balance Sheet podcast, where we meet leading investors and commentators and educate ourselves about the world of investing and the world. Our mission is to remove some of the mystique around investing and improve our understanding of what makes a successful investment, or indeed an unsuccessful one. Our goal is to inform, educate, and entertain. We hope you enjoy this and every episode.
Behind the Balance Sheet and affiliates and podcast guests may own shares or have an economic interest in securities discussed in this podcast, which is aired for your education and entertainment only. Nothing in this podcast should be construed as investment advice or relied upon for investment decisions. Always do your own research.
It's sometimes called going off piste, and in investing it's usually called style drift. And that's what this podcast episode does. I interview a man who's an angel investor and has made 75 investments, but he also has terminal cancer and has experienced a lot of tragedy in his life. I wanted listeners to this podcast to learn about investing and about life. Spoiler, in this episode, you won't learn that much about investing, but I hope that, like me, you'll learn something about life from this courageous man. There isn't a charity ad this month. Instead, I would encourage you to buy Peter's book, Public Success, Private Grief. I recorded with him a few weeks ago now, and his story left a real impression on me. Not a day since has gone by without me thinking how lucky I am. Paradoxically and ironically, of all my guests, the person who could perhaps teach me the least about investing has taught me the most about life. So Peter Cowley, he's been a businessman for 50 years, invested in 76 startups, had a 100 bagger in 6 years, mentored over 1,000 entrepreneurs, was Business Angel of the Year, received an honorary doctorate, chaired and been a director of several different charities. Yet, as we shall hear, the private life has been in a stark contrast to this business success. Peter, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much, Stephen.
So listen, I saw the movie Joe Black last weekend. I don't know if you've seen it.
I haven't, no.
A slightly bizarre story. So the Grim Reaper is played by Brad Pitt, and he comes to end the life of a media tycoon played by Anthony Hopkins. But he's curious about Hopkins' life, and he grants him a life extension if the Reaper can spend time with Hopkins. So Hopkins, of course, agrees, and Pitt shadows him. Now, it sounds awful, but it's actually a surprisingly good movie, with Pitt falling in love with Hopkins' daughter, a boardroom battle for control of the company, and much more. But its airing was good timing, because I thought, when I was watching that movie, that you're playing a role similar to the one that Hopkins played. So we'll get into how you became an angel investor and more later, but let's start with your cancer. Tell us how your life has been for the last couple of years since you were diagnosed with terminal cancer.
Yeah, so I was about 65 when I found out, or just nearly 66. I'd just done a half marathon, only my third half marathon. I'd only started running when I was about 63. Didn't realize I liked it. Hated it to start with, like many runners. I'm actually doing a half marathon at the weekend again, and then in 2 weeks' time, I'm doing one in Lisbon, so doing two in a fortnight, and I'm 68 now. And a bit overweight, as you can probably see. Anyway, so I run the half marathon. And then literally within a couple of weeks, I found I couldn't cycle any longer. And if I walked across a room, I would just have to touch things. But I could run still. So I was still doing 5Ks, but I couldn't walk. Really weird.
Balance.
It was balance, exactly. I'll cut the story short. But basically, I talked to the GP. The GP said I should see a neurologist. The neurologist said he was flummoxed after he saw me because the symptoms I was showing was clearly a brain tumor, but not one he'd ever seen before. Anyway, MRI, found the secondaries. Luckily, it was secondaries, so I knew at that point it wasn't brain cancer. I was doing far too much Googling at that point, like most people do in these circumstances. Then they found the primary, which is lung. I've never smoked, so it's a never smoke lung cancer. One in five of us who get lung cancer and have never smoked. And then I went, it had a really tough 3 months, something I couldn't possibly be in front of you during those 3 months. I was all over the place. I was on steroids. I was not sleeping. I was, you know, seeing people, making sure I thought I was going to die in a month. And then luckily, I happened to have a cancer that AstraZeneca and it's their best-selling drug at the moment, $7 billion last year, decided to target about 15 years ago. And it's a tablet. So it's a targeted therapy that's just purely targeted at my particular mutation of cancer, and I've had very few side effects. I have had a mutation, which is expected after a while. That mutation was zapped with radiotherapy, and I'm now about 2 and a bit years into my journey. Unfortunately, to go back to your film analogy, it's normal. Normal because there's lots of data on this. There's hundreds of thousands of people on this medication, this targeted therapy. It's normal to be about 18 months to the point of mutation. I was 17.9 months, and it's normal, inverted commas, to be about 18 months to death. And I'm about 8 or 9 months into that. So I do expect not to have much time next year.
So I've been reading your book, and you talk about this, and you wrote your life expectancy when the cancer mutates is likely 18 months, or you described it as 500 days. And it's a very difficult number to read, let alone to have to face. What do you do when you just have 500 days to live? I mean, you've got married, you bought a soft top Porsche, you've been to Antarctica. Tell us a bit about that.
Oh, well, obviously you live life to the full if you can. If for many people with cancer, they're not able to do this. They're on chemotherapy cycles, immunotherapy cycles. They're tied to the hospital wherever they are, etc. I've just been super lucky that this targeted therapy, A, was invented, and B, does work for me. Now, if you've read the book, you'll see I've lived life to the full pretty much anyway for the last, since I got over my alcoholism about 25 years ago. I've just increased that, really. I've got time, I've got motivation, I've got a wonderful new partner, Lisbeth, and I'm just doing stuff. And one of the things I'm doing, though, very specifically, is this book, because I feel it is my final legacy, really. I'm hoping that the book will inspire others, and I hope so will this conversation. So I'm just getting on with things, but it's not just being selfish. I mean, obviously writing the book isn't a selfish thing. There's some catharticism about it, but most of the time it's for people who will read it. And I suspect it'll be more popular after I'm dead than before I'm dead, so I will never see the results of that. So doing that, and then I'm spending special time with a few very close friends. There was a guy who was head of KPMG who died of brain cancer at 5 months' notice about 20 years ago. He called it unwinding. I don't actually like the term unwinding, but I'm going to spend time 2-3 days blacksmithing with a friend from Yorkshire, going on a stand-up comedy course with my life coach, Katie Tunser, who you saw in the book, et cetera, and then possibly doing some hiking, some time, obviously, with my remaining son, and spending time with Lise. We're going to the Arctic, actually, in July, having been to the Antarctic.
And what was the Antarctic like?
What I took away from it wasn't quite what I expected, so my expectations from a certain point. The animal life, although very interesting, is not very varied. Penguins, seals, and of course orcas and humpback whales. The largest creature that actually lives on Antarctica is just over a centimetre long, apart from the 1,500 researchers who are living in huts, of course. So the beauty is there, clearly. What I took about it, really, was how extraterrestrial the continent is. It doesn't feel like it could possibly exist on this planet. And of course, there was the climate change issues and all the other things we learned about.
When you had evidence that cancer started to mutate, you wanted to get treatment, and you didn't get CyberKnife treatment because it wasn't a new cancer. Can you talk a bit about your feelings about that? I happen to have not. I mean, everybody has got cancer, has touched everyone's lives in some way or another, and I happen to know there's a CyberKnife in St. Bart's which isn't running 24 hours a day saving lives, because the conditions to qualify are so stringent. And it just seems to me like incredibly stupid to spend, I don't know how much these machines are, 10 million or tens of millions of pounds.
I mean, I've seen the machine, obviously. I know quite a bit about technology. I would thought it would be at the sort of 1 to 2 million mark, but still an expensive asset to keep idle, like an aircraft, a large aircraft.
I mean, what's with the health service? Why have they got this wrong?
The CyberKnife, I've actually Googled and found the document which defines what the NHS does with the CyberKnife machine. And it's a Saber machine, a static, I can't remember the exact term, but it's radiotherapy, concentrated high-energy radiotherapy. And I read it, and I could not believe that they weren't going to offer me it. And that's because there was one word in the title that I'd skipped over but didn't understand, Metachronus. Now, I don't know if you know what Metachronus is. Maybe if you did Greek at A-level, you might know, but I didn't understand that was. So the problem for the NHS was that the tumour where it had mutated, which was in my hip, so it's very easy to get to with radiotherapy, was in the same place as an existing tumour. So one that had been shrunk by the target therapy was mutated, as opposed to a new one. And at that point, and we're talking about 9 months ago, and I suspect it hasn't changed much, the internal process or procedure with or protocol, sorry, within the NHS is not to offer CyberKnife for synchronous, i.e. in the same place, tumours, which is why I then bought it. You know, I have the resources to buy it from a private provider. There have to be rules. Oh, the NHS needs to, you know, we know a lot about the NHS, don't we? We hear a lot about it anyway. We know, we all got friends who are in it. They've got to somehow make decisions about resource allocation.
You seem very calm about it when it's your own situation. I think
when we come on to some of the other things that have happened in my life, you'll understand this is fairly minor compared with some of the things that have happened to me.
Yes, well, we'll get on to that. In the book, you write almost a checklist about coping with cancer, gather knowledge, talk about it, carry on a normal life, exercise, stay positive, build a relationship with the medical team, keep as much control as you can. I mean, these all sounded very laudable aims, but how do you stay positive?
I don't honestly know that. I've had quite a lot of therapy over the years for various things, and I've never been able to work out why. I don't think I'm deluded, and I don't think I'm just burying grief of various sorts. It will come out. It may come out during this interview. I might end up in tears when we talk about other things. I don't know. I just feel life is for living somehow, and I'm not. It's not that I'm not emotionally aware enough to work out how I work. I mean, probably I'm a white elder male, so from a public school, so I probably don't understand that much about myself. So no, I just, if I was grief-stricken by the cancer or the deaths of my two sons or whatever, then I wouldn't be in this room for a start, and I wouldn't be much fun to spend any time with. So even it's internal that I am positive, but on top of that, I feel very strongly I've got to remain positive for all those around me, my wife, my son, anybody who makes any contact. And of course, I enjoy life a lot more if I'm positive because other people are positive to me.
I mean, that's a very useful lesson to take away. But I mean, you have had so many tragedies in your life. I mean, I was really struck reading the book, starting with the death of your younger brother in 1980, age 21. Your brother died of leukemia. So did your university friend, Tony, that you worked on. You worked in a frozen pea line together at university. Another university friend died, leaving four young children. Then your ex-wife died, another ex-girlfriend. I mean, I can't imagine that just this happening to you on an almost regular basis makes it any easier to deal with. I mean, what coping mechanisms do you have to handle the death of someone close to you?
A number of things. I'm very open to accepting love and advice from others, whether they're, you know, loved ones, trusted friends, professionals. I've seen many therapists over the years. So I'm willing to analyze, because I'm a very analytical person, as you can tell from the book, all my spreadsheets around the place. I'm willing to analyze and work on what I'm going through. On top of that, as you again read in the book, this word busyness with a Y instead of an I, there's no doubt I've dug myself into busyness in order to avoid things. So this effectively, as you know, I'm sure you've been through the same situation. If you put a bit of a shell around you, then you can hide stuff temporarily. You've still got to process it at some point. Otherwise, it'll break out and you'll end up with some sort of breakdown or whatever, as we see in people. So it's a combination of allowing other people to help me and requesting that help, and helping others, of course, as well, as we'll come on to with the books and so on. Keeping busy while I process that somehow in a way that, and by busy, I don't mean in a self-centered way, but busy helping others. All the charitable work I've done, all the mentoring I've done, all the books I've written, all the podcasts I've done, etc. Otherwise, I don't know. I had a family background in Hull, in Yorkshire, from up north. At least we're pretty direct up north compared with further south, which I've lived most of my life. So we certainly didn't talk about things at home. So it can't have been my upbringing that allowed me to be this. It must have been things that have developed since then.
You mentioned therapists. I mean, it was this posture alcoholism. I can't say it.
It was pre, initially, of course, to try and get over what I was going through. Initially forced on me, and then gradually me accepting it, and then after several years, finally getting sober. And then it was, there was something to do with the separating and getting divorced from my first wife, the mother of my children. Clearly a lot more on the death of my first son back in 2009. And it's something that, providing the chemistry's right between me and the therapist, something that works really, really well for me.
And you mentioned your son, Ian, died in 2009, and another son, Alan, died in October 2022, both from suicide. There's a couple in, I think it's in New Jersey, who won the lottery twice, which is, I don't know what the odds of that are. I don't even know why you would do it a second time. But you've done this, like, in reverse. And, I've never even heard of somebody having such bad luck. But what I hadn't realized, and you wrote in the book, suicide's the most common cause of death for males between 20 and 40 years old. What advice do you have for parents?
So, the problem with the male, the younger male, is that we're actually, males are not so good about talking about things, as we know. I have no clue what you're like, but I know I was a very reserved person, extremely reserved person. And so actually being able to talk to others about one's internal strife is really important. And the Australians are actually working a lot on this. You can imagine the macho Australian male. We've seen those around on movies and things like that. So if you work backwards to their teenagers, you can probably imagine that they're probably less able to talk than, you know, us rather reserved Anglo-Saxons here in the UK. So there's a lot of programs going on to try and help males, younger males, talk and understand and be able to talk. If they don't talk at that point, be willing to talk at some point. So that is helping. The number of suicides in the world, although it's very difficult to measure, has come down by something like 30% in the last 20 years, despite the population increasing by whatever it is, probably getting on for double. So there's that. There's the other issue is that males, if they do attempt suicide, tend to use methods that are more likely to succeed. Right. I don't want to go into any details for that, but it's fairly obvious what I'm meaning there. So a combination of not being able to talk and attempts being more successful means that the number of males who die, this is in the UK specifically, though I'm sure it's replicated around the world, is between the ages of 20 and 35 or 40 is more. It used to be, of course, motorbikes and cars and things, but it's now suicide. So what advice, to go back to your question, learn about it yourself and then reach out to support networks, and there are plenty of those around. The one I'm particularly got involved with is called Papyrus, which is the largest suicide prevention charity for under 35s in the UK. You might have heard of the Three Dads.
Yes.
Sandy Airy, who's on the board, is actually one of the Three Dads, and they're actually bringing a book out about a month after mine, and they've done these huge walks. They've raised literally millions of pounds. They've been in and out of Parliament. They're putting a lot of effort into, in their case, they were daughters, actually, that died, not sons.
You talked about you haven't had a drink in almost 24 years, but you used to have a glass of gin. Was it gin or vodka? Or
people tend to move, alcoholics tend to move to white spirits. The reason you move to white spirits is they don't give you a headache in the same way that a beer or a red wine or a port or something would do. So you tend to move to that because you get more bang for your buck. You get more alcohol units per amount of liquid. And so, I used to pretend I was a bit of a posh alcoholic because I drink gin rather than vodka. But it's usually vodka that people will end up on when they get to that point.
And that was your breakfast?
Hopefully you've never experienced it, though some of the people that are listening might have done. But delirium tremens, where the body shakes, the way to get away from that, unfortunately, is to have a drink. Because once you've had it, so if you're shaking in the morning, and if you take that too far, let the DTs get too bad, you'll end up with what I had, which was an epileptic fit. But to avoid that, you have a drink. And of course, once you've had a drink at breakfast, you've completely screwed that day.
Well, I used to work with a guy who had two double vodkas before lunch, but he remained remarkably coherent. At what point do you think alcohol becomes a problem?
That's up to the individual to say. there's a, as you'll have seen in the book, one of the mantras of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is how I got sober and remain sober, is that nobody can call another person an alcoholic. The alcoholic can call themselves one, and that's where your drinking is affecting your own health and others, other people's health and relationship beyond what you're willing to accept. Now, of course, alcoholism, like any form of addiction, is completely coupled with denial. So, you know, I would be drinking and be on the phone to a customer because I was a functioning drunk, pissed out of my head and thinking that was okay.
But could people detect that?
Of course they could. And I had one, my largest customer, who is probably retired now, would accept that. You know, I was doing such, or my company, my technology company, was doing such a good job that that worked okay. That's very unusual. I wouldn't recommend that to anybody. So I was functioning, and you know, which allowed me to have a semblance of a life. I've met many, many people in AA where things had got that bad where they didn't have anything. They would be literally living rough.
You called that the lost decade.
I did.
So it affected your life for 10 years.
Exactly.
And you gave up drink once. Well, how could you have started again? Was it just, it's a slippery slope sort of thing?
No. It's called white knuckling or being a dry drunk. So although I wasn't drinking, and this went on for about 5 months, I was still thinking like a drunk. I hadn't processed through. So I was remaining sober by not picking up a drink. And then I got to the point after about 5 months, as it says in the book, and I went out to dinner with my bank manager and other people, and I was driving. So I thought, I can have a glass of wine here. I had a glass of wine, and that was it. Literally within 2 or 3 weeks, I was back on the vodka. And it's only when I finally, and I went to rehab 3 times in the end, it was only that final time where it was coupled with an AA process, and I'd been going to AA while drinking for the 6 months beforehand, that suddenly I had something that would support me once I came out of rehab. And that was AA. It doesn't work for everybody, but it worked incredibly well for me.
Why did it work for you?
Because of the support network around me once I got back out of the rehab. Because there's alcohol in every single corner, the corner shop, the pub, the restaurant, in the house and everything. They can obviously take it out of the house. So it worked because I had the meetings, the AA meetings to go to. I had the love and support of other people around, and specifically the sponsor. Sponsor is a term within AA, which is somebody you're particularly close to, which you will, if you have any crisis of any form, you'll talk to.
Because I imagine that it's that availability that's the issue. Because I was a smoker. And I gave up smoking. I actually gave up smoking with the help of a hypnotist. And, of course, the first thing he says is get rid of that. You know, go home, throw out all your ashtrays, throw out all your lighters, throw out everything that reminds you of a cigarette. And that doesn't make a huge...
It does, but you'd still be spending time with people who smoked. In the same way, I still needed to have human contact.
Yeah.
And people do drink. You know, and if you go to pick up a newspaper in some shops, it'll be the vodka and behind the shelf. So it requires more than just throwing it all out of the house. You have to live.
Yeah, no, that's what I mean. It must be much more difficult. I mean, I think because once you stop smoking, you find being in the company of smokers slightly unpleasant. And of course, nobody smokes in the UK. Have you got any big plans for the coming up? I mean, what are you going to be doing?
Obviously, I'm hoping and expecting and praying, although I'm not religiously praying, that I will have more than my allocated 250 or so days. And I'm doing my best in terms of research and other things and keeping very fit, as I said earlier on. But I do need to also, because I'm a numbers guy, I do need to plan in case that the inevitable does happen, and it won't just be in a death. It'll be some weeks or months, as we see with people on chemo, of really pretty tough times.
Yeah.
So at the moment, I'm getting on a 3 month cycle. So I scanned every 3 months. That's how it detects whether the cancer is returning or growing or whatever, or mutating. I have my scans next week, and then I'm told a week later, and then I can plan the following 3 months. Obviously, I'm putting stuff in place and sort of penciling it in my diary, but I can't pen it in. I can't commit to large expenditure until I've given that 3 months clear. So I've got something that I think I'm doing in the next 3 months, the Arctic in the following 3 months, and I'm gradually building up this time with other people. So that's what I'm doing at the moment. If it does work, that I live for several more years, I've got to replan. And it'll be an interesting situation where if I have to carry on living, which obviously I want to, on this three-month cycle for many years, it could get quite difficult to work out what to do. So I haven't got any big project after the book, although there is another book floating around in my mind at the moment, which is about the Cambridge Angels. We might talk about the Cambridge Angels later. It's a group that I've been involved with for a long time in Cambridge. Maybe there's a history of Cambridge Angels in me somehow. But no, so it's time with people. It's you know, it's spending time. You saw about the bucket list and the fuck it list. Avoiding the fuck stuff on the fucking, you know, there's a list there. I tend to create that in real time, actually, where the bucket list is very concrete, as we were just saying.
No, we were talking about it. What would you do if you knew how long you had to live and you only had 500 days left? You'd want to make absolute most of them. So I'm grateful to you for giving up one of them or half of them to come talk to me. But
exactly, not just you, Stephen. It's the listeners, it's your audience. Yeah, yeah. I'm hoping I can inspire your audience in some way or other.
If you enjoy this podcast, you're bound to enjoy our free newsletter on Substack. It's a weekly email on interesting investing topics. Visit behindthebalancesheet.com and hit the sign up button. While you're there, you might want to check out our brilliant online investor training school. Hundreds of students have taken our flagship Analyst Academy course, which teaches you everything you need to become a serious equity investor. And if you're a professional investor, we run a forensic accounting course for institutional clients, and soon a cohort-based course for serious amateurs. Email us at info@behindthebalancesheet.com.
So this is a business show. We haven't talked about business yet, and I'm keen to explore, because you've done an amazing number, 75, 76 investments in startups. You'd done some angel investing before you set up the current vehicle. What made you do that?
My background was a little bit of time in a software company here in London after I left university. But then very rapidly, I moved out to Bavaria to join a small company. This is back in 1980. That was going bust, got sold. So I formed my first tech company back in 1981. And I've formed about a dozen businesses since then. Go forward, go through the failure of Camdata, the resurrection of Camdata, which is now, which I still run, or my wife and I run. It's now 40 years old. And I got back to Cambridge where I'd studied, and because of a relationship change, and I was doing lots of things. I was involved in property development. I was a charity. I was sales marketing director of a med tech company. Lots and lots of things. And then I set up a mentoring scheme or a coach mentoring scheme for the people who'd done computer science at Cambridge, because that's what my third year was. And in that process, I met somebody who wanted to start a company up. Top of his year, super bright guy, Martin Kleppmann. And I helped him do that. And I helped him do that by being on the board, which is very important to me, that you learn so much and give so much that way, much more than as an individual shareholder, and put a bit of money in. And we managed to flip it, inverted commas, in 3 years at about 17 or 18x. So I didn't put much money in. I class it as car changing, house changing, and life changing. And it was sort of car changing, but it was a second-hand car and not a Porsche. So it was a lot of money. But the point was, during that process, I found out what an angel investor was. So this was about 2007, 2008, and thought, I really enjoy this. I actually really enjoy helping other people, usually a generation or a bit younger than me, and not having to worry about the day-to-day grind of building a business, which is much more than the grind of building a big corporate. The stresses, the mistakes you can make that can make a huge difference to failure or success are all much greater. So I thought, oh, I quite enjoy this. And from that, because of a friend I knew anyway who'd set up the Cambridge Angels, a guy called Robert, he suggested, or together we worked out, it would be a good idea if I joined the Cambridge Angels, which is a group of high net worths in Cambridge.
And you set up this Martlet Capital vehicle for you and the Marshall family co-invest. As I said, you've done 70 odd, but when you started that in April 2011, I was quite amazed to read you did one a month from launch until the end of that year. I think timing's really important. The vintage is much more critical to the IRR than any other factor, particularly in private equity, but I suspect it's true in venture capital as well.
Vintage is really important, extremely important. I mean, it's the same with any form of investing. You take a time slice and you get a wealth manager who says, I've done so well, and you move that time slice by a year, they haven't done well at all. So one can always use statistics to prove one's point. And that's exactly right. And as it turns out, though, this is not through planning. I slowed down investing as I headed to my 65th birthday, which is 3 years ago, because I thought, and unfortunately I probably won't make it, that most angel-based investments where you invest in the very first round in deep tech take 10 or more years to result in an exit, and 65 plus 10 or more years is getting on a bit, isn't it? Getting on towards 80, so I'd slowed down. That was about the time that availability of capital was so strong that the valuations were just rocketing up. Very different nowadays. So I'd sort of caught it in a good time, as it turns out. I personally, sort of post the Citi crash, the 07, 08, 09 crash, obviously I had nothing to do with the 2000 crash, and then stopped before it overheated in the market.
I mean, there wasn't that much happening in 2007, 2008, was there?
There was much less than there is now, but there's still a lot of wannabe entrepreneurs who needed capital. And then those days you could put together around for, say, 250K. The people would have a 750K pre-money valuation because they normally sell a quarter or a third for 250K. And they would use that 250K very efficiently, capital efficiently, over the next 18 months and actually reach a point where the enterprise value had gone up, say, 2X or 2.5X, something like that, and then raise perhaps 750 on a 2 million or 2.5 million valuation, which ensured they weren't being diluted too much, the founders, and also, of course, ensuring that the early investors were still on a good slope.
It's interesting because the environment today is very different. I mean, I tried to do the first startup external round of funding probably 20 years ago, and we had a terrible, terrible time. It was terribly difficult. I mean, I actually managed to raise the capital, but only because I was well connected, and I raised capital from a very famous billionaire who I knew. But obviously, for most people, that wouldn't have been available. You prefer startups to scale ups. Talk about the different skills.
Yes, so my skill is clearly startup, and it took me a while to work out that actually I wasn't very good on scale up. I was on the board of a company called Arachnis, which sold to a lot of people in the city, KYC and AML for finance institutions primarily. Right. And when we got to about 80 people, I realized my skills weren't really what was needed any longer. I'm much better at that startup phase, which of course is true also of many entrepreneurs. They need to replace themselves with a professional manager. Usually, not always. There's obviously examples like Richard Branson and other people who never need to do that.
Well, Richard Branson never does anything.
Maybe he never did anything. Maybe he was just a brand person and he got other people to do it. Exactly. But it's usually the case where once you get to perhaps 50 to 100 people, it's probably better if a professional manager comes in and they step down to be CPO or life president or whatever. And that was the case because I've set up so many businesses and been involved in so many early stage. There's 90 businesses I've either invested in or founded together. And I've been on the board of probably 25 of those. And when it gets to a certain size, and scaling is a term that's misused a lot, when it gets to a certain size, there's a point where I'm not enjoying it so much and my contribution is less. So I'm better off helping somebody else.
Very unusual for someone to recognize that their particular skills and their particular limitations, and great respect for you for being able to do that. The trick in venture is how many failures you get. And I always think this is more interesting than the successes.
Absolutely.
There's much more, not more to learn from, but
there is more to learn, personally. I do think there's more to learn.
So, you talked in the book about a couple of them. Would you, Eagle Planes and Captive Media advertising to 18 to 35-year-old males? I like that one particularly. Would you talk a bit about some of the, maybe talk about those or
others? Yeah. Most of the failures, and I'm very open about this, as you saw, petercowley.org, you'll see my statistics, my investment criteria, my investments, my failures, my successes, and although I haven't had a legal letter yet, my reasons, I think, why they failed. So nobody's pushed back on that. Almost all failures are due to product market fit not being reached before investment stops. So take a situation where you haven't got to the point where you've got a big enough market, you're selling at the right price to get the right contribution, the right gross margin, that actually you've got to break even. Where does the money come from? It's not going to come from debt at that point. The banks are never going to touch it unless they underwrite it with your house or something, if you've got a house. So it's got to come from investors. And if the investors lose faith, you've got a business that needs the money, not got to break even, where does it go from there? It has to sell itself, fire sale, has to shrink, or has to close. And those 20 have all closed. They've probably gone through processes of shrinking first, which is super painful, but they've then closed. So it's to do with product market fit. It's to do with turning the company into a normal, proper business that's generating EBITDA, generating profit, before the investors give up, which is just the same on the stock market, I'm sure. But the early stage companies, it's not so much if it's a profitable company.
Of course.
And so those are mostly the failures. Ego Aeroplanes, super cool product. They'd done lots of market research. There was had been a competition for a single seater that didn't need certification. So it had to be a certain glide angle, I think it was. It had to be a certain weight. And so that the single seater, i.e. the pilot, would be the only person who died if it crashed, basically. So obviously nobody wanted to crash. And this company put in a proposal and won the competition and then turned that into a business and raised not a lot, $2 million, $2.5 million. Did a big market research at the beginning. Hundreds of people wanted them for a certain price. Couldn't even dream of making that price in the end.
What? But what made you invest in that?
Because it was Cambridge, because it was engineering, and because there was a bit of pressure from not a billionaire, but somebody worth a fair amount who felt that Martlet and me and others. So the cap table was made up of enthusiastic aviators who just loved it anyway, who just wanted it to be there. You know, they were sort of donating money almost. And then a few of us who put money in under a bit of pressure from somebody else whose name is nameless. So I have done a podcast with him, but he's nameless.
Wait, well, why would you invest under pressure?
Yeah, that's a really good question. That's a really good question. And this was early days. This was probably 10 years ago. And my set of rules were small at that point, probably 4 or 5. I mean, I had one failure, which you might not have read about, that's 5 months from the point of investment to the failure. I mean, what level of due diligence didn't I do in that to get to that point?
And why did that one fail?
That one failed because the investor director, who I hadn't got to know, but this is really important nowadays if I'm not the investor director myself, allowed the founders to repay about their director's loan, which was about a third of the investment that came in. So they took up, it was only a 90K round. They just need to top up. They're already making they hadn't got a break even, but they were trading. And a third of that came straight out of the company. You know, I was so naive at this point. This is back 11, 12 years ago.
And normally that just wouldn't be allowed to happen. You raise money for growth.
Exactly. You don't want, I mean, the private equity will allow money to come in and go back out again, as happened with my 107X, my bagger, as you called it. But almost always VCs want the money to be used from the bank account of the startup.
The James & James, the 107 bagger in 6 years, pretty impressive. You had 18, I think, exits. What's the secret to getting a successful exit?
Well, luck is one of them. Careful choosing, whatever that means. And this doesn't mean careful choosing necessarily of the plan or the idea, but it's careful choosing of the founders. I have this saying, I invest in people with a plan, not a plan with people. So choosing those. And then on top of that, either me personally or people I trust and know helping them on the journey. Because particularly if the founders are young, you know, mid-20s, then there's so many mistakes they'll make. They won't understand human relationship. They won't understand business processes. They'll be hugely over-optimistic, which most entrepreneurs are anyway, of course. So just helping them on that journey. So, yeah, although the numbers on the website are 2020, that isn't what matters. It's how much you put in and how much you take out, as any investor knows. And it's around about 3x. So I put a certain amount in, which is, you know, in the over a million, but not millions, and have had about 3 times that out, and I've still got 36 or so to go. So, yeah, luck, making sure that you back your winners, of course. So Arachnis, it was my largest single investment over a period of 7 or 8 rounds. James & James, 107X, was probably my smallest individual investment.
How do you size them?
That's gut, really. And so I put much more in, and I follow on for many more rounds if I'm involved with the company, because I've got much more information, almost insider information, and I've got much more influence. I might have a bit of control, but it's the influence that matters.
And you always follow on then?
The messaging, if one's invested director and doesn't follow on, is pretty negative, as you can imagine. You've been on the board, you've been on the board for, say, 2, 3, 4 years, and you're not writing another check. It was fine once I got cancer, really good excuse. Wasn't too bad when I got 65, because I was very public about the fact I was going to do that. But if it's before that, it's really negative.
And started a publishing business, so you self-published your first 2 books. You're self-publishing your 3rd book as well?
Unfortunately, I am, because I just found, as you haven't seen the preface yet, but because it's, in fact, it's actually being finalized tomorrow. The final document will be released to copy editing and then on the way to print tomorrow. So that by talking to a lot of people in publishing, I ended up producing a pitch deck, although it's called a book proposal, put it out to about 16, 17 people. And there were 3 things that stopped. One, I needed to read the whole book, and we weren't ready for that, though we are now. Secondly, they wanted me to be famous already, so 100,000 social media followers. I've only got 10,000. And thirdly, by far the most important, the time from contacting a publisher to being, say, in a bookshop or on Amazon is usually 18 to 24 months, and I don't think I've got that time.
It's a weird industry.
I've got to know it quite well. And
the processes, getting the, you know, from the time that you the book's ready to the time it gets in the bookshop, there's no reason why it needs to be that long, as far as I can see.
No, hence, of course, self-publishing and Amazon. I mean, that makes it so much easier. I mean, I don't know why you publish. We haven't talked about it. I don't know why you publish yourself, but you could have self-published it if you're willing.
There's a very simple reason for that, because I had the idea that I would write a book, and I went out to breakfast with a friend of mine who's a former journalist in PR, and he said, oh, you need an agent. And so I got an agent, and the agent persuaded a lady at Wiley to have an email exchange with me, and she couldn't find the time to actually speak to me. And he basically just gave up, and nobody was interested. And I was just so grateful, because I happened to meet the people for Harriman House, or my publisher, and I was just so grateful that they agreed to publish it. I didn't even negotiate in the contract. I just said, I need a publisher. I did it stupidly. I hadn't done any research. Mm-hmm. And of course, in actual fact, Harriman are lovely people, and I'm pleased that I've went with them, because there have been some other benefits. Strangely, I had to do most of the marketing myself, including writing the blurb at the back. And I was like, well, I thought that was what you did. But there have been some benefits, because we've sold the rights to my book in the Spanish-speaking world, in China, in Korea, in Russia, Russian advance I've actually donated to buy Ukrainian ambulances. But I now have a joint venture in Korea that with an online education platform, which I wouldn't have had had it not been through the contacts of the publishers.
I'm hoping that if this is successful, and I've done enough marketing of it, and we had a double spread piece in the Times a couple of weeks ago, it should be on Bloomberg Radio in the next couple of weeks, that actually a publisher will pick it up. And that I don't mind, but I want to get out the first thousands, however many that is, and then from then on, perhaps it will it'll go wider.
Funny enough, my friend who was raising money for the Ukrainian ambulance, a guy called Whitney Tilson, who's very well known in the investment world, he has visited 76 countries, and you have visited 90 countries. And I did a game with my kids years ago one night, and we were traveling, and we counted how many countries we'd been to, and I counted 70-odd. But I mean, how do you keep track of how many countries you've been to? Is this a spreadsheet?
I'm geeky. I'm just geeky. I set it up probably about 15 years ago. I've got them all with... I found some list somewhere, which is out of date, because it had Yugoslavia on it, for instance, which I've had to break down into Croatia and Slovenia and all the rest of it. And I've just, as it turns out. So I've just keep this going. Not all those countries have I spent an overnight in. So I have a separate list of countries, you know, been into Bahrain and then back out again, for instance. But there's only, and I've been to Uruguay and Paraguay, but only for the day. So I haven't stayed overnight in them, but that's about 10 of them. But the rest of them, I've just adored travel, mate. As you read in the book, my father's a dentist. You know, made money, and certainly in the 60s and 70s. We even used to, no, it's not in the book, he used to fly the car to the continent. So we used to drive down to somewhere in Kent, and three cars would go into an airplane and we'd fly over the channel. We'd very, very keen travellers, and that just wore off on me. And of course, I lived abroad in Germany. I reckon lived about 10 years. I've been outside the UK over the years, and holiday and business.
And one of those countries is Borneo, and you enjoy hiking. You climbed Kote Kinabalu in 2007 with your son.
Yes.
I want you to tell us about that and how you felt afterwards. So I did that. So my wife said, oh, we're going to go to this thing, and you can just stay in the hotel if you don't want to climb the mountain.
That was the hut on the way up, was it? Or the one on the bottom?
No, the one on the bottom. I don't really fancy that. And so I climbed with her, and afterwards, we went to the best hotel in town before we were flying up, because we didn't have enough time. We stayed overnight, and the following morning, they came up and asked me, do you need a wheelchair? Because I was finding it so hard to walk down. I couldn't walk down the stairs because my legs were so stiff. How was your experience?
It matches that so much. I remember, because the descent, assume you do the same. You go from the bottom, the entrance to the park, you go to this hut, you stay overnight, you get up at some ungodly time in the morning at 3 or 4 in the morning.
But we got altitude sick.
That's strange, because the hut's not that high. It's lower than many ski resorts, actually, that hut. The top is about Mont Blanc, but the hut isn't that high. So you're unlucky.
Yeah, I don't know why.
But probably was the same. The reason for your wheelchair and my almost wheelchair was coming down again, because of course it's a long drop down. I don't know how many it was, 7,000 feet of descent. You know, 1,800 meters of no height difference. Sorry, over a period of several miles, and there's steps, aren't they? I walked around Annapurna once with a big rucksack on and did 5,000 feet of descent on steps. That was a similar feeling, except I was 20 years younger. But yeah, can imagine, I even picture myself there on the bottom few steps, feeling wrecked by this descent.
It was a memorable trip, although it was a struggle to get up the mountain, because my wife was so taken with altitude sickness. Yeah, she's much fitter than I am. She was really, really struggling. And so I kept saying to her, oh, the top's just over the over the next hill.
It isn't that, because it's seriously flat, that top, isn't it?
Yeah. It keeps going. It keeps going forever. Any other hikes that you've done that have been really memorable?
Well, I mentioned that Annapurna. This was pre-kids, and we just had a rucksack, and we walked around Annapurna. The year after it opened up, actually, this was back in 1983. So I've done that, which is a decent hike. The coast to coast in the UK. Been up the highest point in Northern Europe, so not Mont Blanc. I've never been to Mont Blanc, but which is called Hyppingen in Norway. That was really memorable because it was soft snow all the way up. And again, it was about a 5,000 foot, 1,600 meter ascent and descent. Done Tongariro Crossing in North Island, New Zealand a couple of times. I've done the Pennine Way. I've done some of the GR10, which is a Pyrenean one. It goes from coast to coast, but only some of that. So yeah, I'm a pretty keen hiker when I can. And skier. I've been skiing for 47 years now. So.
Where did you ski?
So this year I went with my son to Les Arcs because he was leading a school ski trip somewhere else. I just met him in Geneva. And then I went with some, we call ourselves the old geezers, to the Dolomites for another week.
All right, that's cool. Well, Peter, listen, it's been really fascinating talking to you. I am so grateful to you giving up your time. And I really sincerely mean that, because I'm conscious how precious that time is. Is there anything that you'd like to leave the listeners and viewers with?
Well, I've really enjoyed this. I had an interview for something recently, and the chemistry wasn't between me, nearly as good as it has between you and me, Stephen. You'll put on the show notes where they can get more information about me and the book.
Yeah, but tell us. Yeah, PeterCowley.org.
Yes, it's PeterCowley.org. The Ancient Investing website, and I've done about 80 podcasts, so I've been the other side of the mic quite often. It's called Investor, all one word, .com, And the book is called Public Success, Private Grief. So I've had a level of public success. Not so famous in terms of football or as a pop star or Jeremy Paxman on TV or something like that. But certainly in my field,
we didn't
mention I was president of the trade body for Angel Investing Europe, and I was on the Global Business Angel Network. So I'm pretty well known in my field, and I've had some success financially as well, though I think there's some luck involved in that. So that's the personal success, and the private grief we've talked about quite a bit. I just seem to have been unlucky. But this, I mean, lots of people are unlucky, of course, and some, I'm still a wealthy person living in an English-speaking country in Western Europe. And there's people in much worse situations than me, of course. But I have, for whatever reason, managed to work my way through these crises, these tragedies, this grief, and somehow come out in a way that's continued to function and to contribute.
Well, I'm looking forward to seeing the finished version of the book because I saw a very early draft. And I thank you again. I think your story is really, honestly inspiring, because for anybody who has got your ticket very close to your end destination, and hopefully, I hope it's a lot longer than the remaining 250 days, for anybody to say that they're lucky and that they're in a good spot, I don't know how you can do that. I take my hat. If I had a hat on, I would take it off to you. Thank you so much.
Well, I hope other people will do it, will be inspired where I've got to, and then when they get to a point where things are really, really super tough, they'll think, well, Peter Cowley managed it, perhaps I can do it.
The most remarkable thing about Peter Cowley is how he can still smile. Here is a man who spent his whole life helping others, yet he's had so much bad luck in his personal life. I don't know how he gets up in the morning, let alone how he's written a book and is willing to go on a podcast to talk about his experiences. While I found Peter's story incredibly sad, I found his attitude and the calm acceptance of his fate remarkable and indeed inspiring. Few listeners to this podcast won't have encountered cancer in some shape or form. And sadly, I know some of you have encountered suicide, which in fact turns out to be much more common than I had realized. You may be relieved to hear I do not plan on doing another episode like this one. It's just too upsetting. But this gave me the opportunity to thank Peter and to wish him longer than 250 more days.